Lauren, you've been recognized this year with the Canada Gardner Whiteman Award. So what is the award and what does it mean to you?
Well, it's an extremely great honor to get the Gardner Whiteman Award because of the type of individuals and the individuals that have been recognized previously. It really is quite a who's who in medical sciences around the world. So it's great to be part of that family from the Gardner Foundation. And again, it recognizes either an individual achievement that has huge societal benefit or a number of different lifetime achievements that continue to have benefit to society. So it's always nice to know that you're doing something that society benefits from and people recognize.
Now, yours wasn't the only one this year. How many other scientists were also recognized with this?
I think there were seven of us in total. A number of them, like three of them from New York, were for one specific, it's a team approach as well. So the Gardner always recognizes about four or five individuals. In fact, since 1959, I think is when they started, they've recognized 256, and 78 of them have gone on to win the Nobel Prize. So again, that's the level of individuals that the Gardner recognizes. So it's nice to be part of that company.
Do you get any money out of it?
Yes, fortunately, there is a $100,000 personal prize for winning the award.
The work that you've been doing over the last few decades deals with vaccines and things related to that. Tell me about what it is that you have been doing that brought you to their attention.
I'm glad you said a few decades because it is a labor of about 38 years of working in virology and vaccines. I guess the first vaccine that I helped develop was against rotavirus, which is a disease that infects every mammal. And we started out with developing a vaccine for calves, which causes scours and diarrhea in calves and kills quite a large number of animals each year. And those that don't die don't do as well once their gastrointestinal tract is damaged. You could see this virus in diarrhea of animals and children, but nobody could ever grow the virus. So you couldn't really develop a vaccine without being able to grow the virus. So I was able to identify, using some tricks, a way to be able to grow the virus. And as a result of that, we could develop rapid diagnostic tests, and then we developed a vaccine first in calves, and then the system that we used was then used to develop a vaccine against children, and the disease would kill about 500,000 children every year. So you can see the significance of developing vaccines. And fortunately, in North America now, rotavirus is almost a thing of the past in children. And then we went on. I was the first associate director and then the director of the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization in Saskatoon. And we developed in total seven different vaccines. Five of them being world firsts. For example, we developed the first genetically engineered vaccine for any animal species. The most recent vaccine that was developed was against E. coli 0157. That's the bacterium that killed a number of people in Walkerton. And again, it's a new concept of vaccinating animals to protect humans. So if you can, because cattle carry the bacterium, never get sick, but they shed it into the environment. So if we found a vaccine that we could vaccinate cows, they would reduce the shedding into the environment. So it really is an environmental vaccine, and of course then protects humans. So, and we always hear of these recalls of bean sprouts, of radishes, of lettuce, etc., and that's all because of these bacteria that are contaminants from animals. And so again, these are just a flavor of the types of things that we were doing. And then most recently, we just finished a large level 3 biocontainment facility in Saskatoon, which was $140 million that in September the Prime Minister opened. So it's again one of the largest facilities of its kind in North America, which will allow Canadians and international community to work with infectious agents that would be difficult to do under normal laboratory conditions.
Well, let's look at this business of vaccines and viruses and going between animal and human species. How is it that you're able to sort of do one kind of to deal with an issue in the animal kingdom, and yet it's able to be applied in the human? Are there that many similarities between us?
Yeah, I mean, it's infectious diseases are really quite smart. In fact, many of the new emerging or re-emerging diseases, about 70% of them, are what we call zoonotic, transmit from animals to humans or from humans to animals. And so animal immune systems are very similar to human immune systems, and it shows that these infectious agents aren't very selective. They can go back and forth. And it's great for them, because the more individuals they have to infect, the better for them.
Well, did I miss something this year? Because this seems to have been the first winter where we haven't had some kind of an alert for a pandemic, say bird flu or something like that.
This winter has been phenomenal in a number of ways. Weather-wise, it's been different. It's rare that you don't have a lot of influenzas, but it has really been a very, very calm winter. But don't become complacent. These microorganisms are lurching somewhere. It's great if we don't have them, but I can predict that within the next year or two, there will be another one. And in fact, in the last 30 years, there have been 30 newly emerged or re-emerging diseases. So I'm not a great mathematician, but I can divide 30 into 30, and it's about one a year. Last year, we had H1N1 influenza. This year we were lucky, but don't be complacent.
I also understand that you did some work with developing a whooping cough vaccine, and that had something to do with the Gates Foundation. What happened there?
Yes, we were fortunate to get one of these Bill and Melinda Gates Grand Challenge grants, which again was a international competition. There was about over 1,500 applicants, then it was narrowed down to a few hundred, and then they funded 43. And they were called grand challenges because they really were looking at things that were really difficult. They were going to challenge all the science that we had. And our project was had a number of challenges, not just one. The first one was to develop a vaccine for neonates, and these are children that are less than a couple of months old. Children of that age respond differently to vaccines. So you had to trick the immune system in a way that these young children would respond. Secondly, we had another challenge that we wanted to do it with a single shot. Today, whooping cough vaccines in North America require 5 shots. That's a huge challenge to go from 5 to 1. And the third challenge was to do it without needles. And why did we want to do all of these challenges? The developing world, it's very difficult to bring a child back to the clinic 5 times. So in many cases, they do not get the full vaccination because they may live in remote communities, etc. And so it's not convenient for them to do it. Secondly, there's a shortage of needles in a lot of the developing world, so they might reuse needles, and as a result of that, transmit other infections. And secondly, needles aren't the most pleasant experience for anybody, I guess. And so we said, well, can we challenge ourselves to address all of these challenges? Happy to report that we were able to achieve all 3 of those challenges, and now we're in the process of testing the stability of the vaccine, going to initiate human clinical trials. We did these trials in animals and we could show it in animals. Now we're moving to the human arena.
a lot of your work over the years you did at the University of Saskatchewan. You left there to come here to the University of Alberta and become the Vice President of Research. But it doesn't sound like you've left your work or your research behind.
Well, as a Vice President of Research, I would be lying if I said that I was still engaged in doing all of the bench work, etc., which I do not do. However, my mind did not go into mush just because I moved from active research to being an administrator. So the answer is yes, I still contribute intellectually, challenge students, challenge researchers. And in fact, I was fortunate to just get a multi-million-dollar grant from the IDRC to develop a vaccine against Rift Valley fever, which is a problem in Africa. However, I'm concerned that it could come to North America and Europe just like West Nile did, and that disease is much more devastating than West Nile virus is. So again, I am not involved in doing the actual experimental work, but I'm involved in the intellectual part of it and deciding how best to approach things, and then have other people that are much smarter than me actually do the work.
Is there something in the way that you approach these diseases that I guess is different from the way we looked at things before that allows you to make so much progress? Have you developed some sort of system or understanding?
Well, I don't know whether we're doing things any differently. I mean, we have a much larger repertoire of techniques and abilities to be able to approach. We know more about the immune system. For example, with the single-shot vaccine, that was built on a tremendous amount of knowledge in immunology of how you link the innate immune response, and I don't want to use terms here that aren't very easily understood by people, but I'll give an example. You may be in at a party on Friday night, and there are people coughing and hacking and have an infection, and there might be 20 people there, and three people get infected, but the other 17 don't. Why is that? It's because you have a natural, we call it an innate response. So you may get infected, but you can very rapidly clear the pathogen and never get sick, and some other people. So we've been able to find out what are some of the tricks that stimulate that early response, which then lead to development of the long-term immune response. So that's why we've combined these types of this knowledge to be able to develop novel approaches to developing vaccines.
You've been here at the University of Alberta since 2007. What is it that attracted you to come here, to leave behind all the good work you were doing in Saskatchewan?
Well, I guess as a person matures and moves on in their career, it's nice to try other experiences. And the University of Alberta is a fantastic university. It's one of the top five universities in the country, one of the top 100 in the world. The team of administrators, the president and the vice presidents, I think are one of the best teams in the country. So it really was an attractive place to come to be able to work as a team. I've always been a team player. I mean, everything I've done has been because of the people around me. And this was a great opportunity to be part of a team in a great university that had a lot of potential opportunities and allowed me to allow my imagination to be able to flourish and have other people around that could do a lot of the exciting things, and all I have to do is facilitate it and they get it done.
So what is it that you are trying to achieve here in this position?
Well, again, as a vice president of research, you're responsible for research across all of the faculties, which is great. You facilitate that, but I also see opportunities to build real centers of excellence in a number of different areas, whether it be in energy and environment, which again, Alberta is a fantastic place, one of the leading places in energy. We have the oil sands. We have a lot of carbon-based industries here, coal, natural gas. We have a lot of expertise in water. We have a lot, and we're developing a center for water, a real initiative. We are fortunate to have funding from the Li Ka-shing Foundation to develop the Institute of Virology. So we're building these flagship areas of expertise, and that will allow us to not only benefit society, improve the reputation of the university, be able to recruit fantastic individuals. This is all areas that, you know, the University of Alberta can be a magnet for talent. And if you have these signature institutes or initiatives, that's what's going to happen. And of course, that brings expertise in other complementary areas. So my goal is to be able to see how do you build these signature initiatives across different faculties and make them interdisciplinary, because that's where I think that a lot of the disruptive technology is going to come from, and the really significant new advances will occur.
What do you see as being the problems or the challenges, the obstacles that you have to overcome in order to, you know, reach that goal?
Funding is always an issue. The other issue is we have, and this is really changing quite dramatically, but we've always been focused in specific disciplines. How do you get people to work with people in different disciplines and respect different disciplines and understand that you can always benefit from listening to other people, even though they think differently? But if you think hard and listen hard, you'll get great ideas, and together you will be able to advance the field. The other thing is there's always this issue of who gets credit for what, and that's a problem in interdisciplinarity. So there are challenges, but I think the rewards far exceed any of the challenges.
You say that you have to look out for research in all areas across all the faculty, so it's not just the sciences. And there seems to be such an emphasis now on commercialization of discoveries, that sort of thing. And some people say, well, gee, we're leaving behind the basic research. But along with that, how do you sort of also bring along the social sciences and the research in there so that those kinds of things don't fall behind?
Well, I think in a university, especially a comprehensive university like ours, is we must support and nurture all of those disciplines. We need to have a balanced approach. I've said to many people, yes, governments are enamored with application and commercialization. And if we put all our effort into applications, we might speed up a few discoveries, but in 5 years' time, the pipeline will be dry because there's no basic research to feed the pipeline. So that's why you need to do basic research. And there's a lot of things in basic research that you don't even know what the application is going to be at. Use the example of lasers. When lasers were discovered, we never had an inkling, and that was a pure basic research concept, never had an inkling of how lasers would impact our lives. Then you talk about social sciences, and I'll give you a couple examples which I feel very passionate about, is that we must include the social sciences in a lot of the natural sciences and engineering activities. I'll give you three examples. First one is genetically modified plants. If we had engaged social sciences in understanding, and I'm not going to say marketing, but educating the public about what genetically modified organisms are, what are the risks, what are the advantages of it, we may have been able to sell genetically modified plants in Europe. We did, I would say, a terrible job in that engaging social sciences. So we could have done that. Because, again, they understand society much better than the hardcore laboratory scientists do. The other one, and that's my favorite one because it's one I know a little bit about, is the human papillomavirus vaccine. Again, industry was very enamored, and scientists got this vaccine, which is probably the best vaccine that's ever been developed. But we paid absolutely no regard to societal issues. And so as a result of that, half of the women are not being immunized. None of the men are being immunized. And as a result of that, people are going to be dying from cervical cancer when we could prevent it extremely well. The other issue is nanotechnology. Everybody's enamored with nanotechnology. And as a result of that, we actually have implemented a arts scholar in residence at our National Institute of Nanotechnology to be able to get the social science people and the arts faculties engaged in a hardcore science, which I think is going to have huge implications for society. You do the same thing with the energy, and how did we could have got social scientists involved in the energy file, and there would be either more or less environmental issues that people are discussing. So to me, it has to be all across faculties, social sciences as much as the hardcore sciences, basic scientists, as well as application, needs to be balanced. But then there are other areas of social sciences, music, drama, which really increases the quality of life of people, but really doesn't have a lot of commercial implications, but boy, it has societal implications and makes Edmonton a better place to live, and we can attract people here because of the other cultural issues. So to me, I think that university has a responsibility to be balanced.
Sounds very holistic. Is that your approach to everything, to life?
I would like to say yes, but I'm sure that people will say, well, you're narrow here, you're narrow there. But I think, and you know, we're actually really limited by our own imaginations. And so the answer is yes. I think we have to look at the world holistically and realize that every single member of our community, whether it be in the university or outside, has something to contribute to the quality of life and the benefit to society. So the answer, I guess, yes.
Thank you very much, Lorne.
My pleasure.